Disc 17.
I began with a salute to the new speaker, who had said he wanted to work with the Democrats in a spirit of civility and bipartisanship. It sounded good, and he might have meant it since the impeachment vote in the House had occurred before he became speaker. So I accepted his offer. By 1999, our economic expansion was the longest in history, with 18 million new jobs since I took office, real wages going up, income inequality finally going down a little, and the lowest peacetime unemployment rate since 1957. The state of our union was stronger than ever, and I outlined a program to make the most of it, beginning with a series of initiatives to create a secure retirement for the baby boom generation. I proposed to commit 60% of the surplus over the next 15 years to extend the solvency of the Social Security Trust Fund until 2055, an increase of more than 20 years, a small portion of it to be invested in mutual funds, an end to the limit on what Social Security recipients could earn without penalty, and more generous payments to elderly women, who were twice as likely as men their age to live in poverty. I also proposed to use 16% of the surplus to add 10 years to the life of the Medicare Trust Fund, a $1,000 long-term care tax credit for the elderly and disabled, the option to let people between the ages of 55 and 65 buy into Medicare, and a new pension initiative, USA accounts, which would take 11% of the surplus to provide tax credits to citizens who open their own retirement accounts and to match a portion of the savings of workers with more modest incomes. This was perhaps the largest proposal ever made to help modest income families save and create wealth. I also proposed a large package of education reforms, arguing that we should change the way we spent the more than $15 billion a year of education aid to support what works and stop supporting what doesn't work by requiring states to end social promotion, turn around failing schools or shut them down, improve the quality of the teaching force, issue report cards on every school, and adopt sensible discipline policies. I again asked Congress to provide funds to build or modernize 5,000 schools and to approve a six-fold increase in the number of college scholarships for students who would commit to teaching in underserved areas. To give more support to families, I recommended a minimum wage increase, expanded family leave, a child care tax credit, and trigger locks on guns so that children could not fire them accidentally. I also asked Congress to pass the Equal Pay and Employment Non-Discrimination Acts, to establish a new American private investment corporation to help raise $15 billion to create new businesses and jobs in poor communities, to enact the Africa Trade and Development Act to open more of our markets to African products, and to fund a $1 billion Lands Legacy Initiative to preserve natural treasures and a package of tax cuts and research money to fight global warming. On national security, I ask for funds to guard computer networks against terrorists and to protect communities from chemical and biological attacks, to increase research into vaccines and treatments, to increase the Nunn-Lugar Nuclear Safety Program by two-thirds, to support the Y River Accord, and to reverse the decline in military spending that had begun at the end of the Cold War. Before closing, I honored Hillary for her leadership in the Millennium Project and in representing America so well all over the world. She was sitting in her box with the home run-hitting Chicago Cubs star Sammy Sosa, who had joined her on a recent trip to his native Dominican Republic. After all she had been through, Hillary got an even bigger round of applause than Sammy. I ended the last State of the Union address in the 20th century by reminding the Congress that perhaps, in the daily press of events, in the clash of controversy, we don't see our own time for what it truly is, a new dawn for America. On the day after the speech, with the highest job approval ratings I had ever had, I flew to Buffalo with Hillary and Al and Tipper Gore to speak to an overflow crowd of more than 20,000 at the Marine Midland Arena. Once again, in spite of all that was going on, the State of the Union address, with its full agenda for the year ahead, had struck a responsive chord with the American people. I ended the month with a major speech at the National Academy of Sciences, outlining my proposals to protect America from terrorist attacks with biological and chemical weapons and from cyber terrorism. A trip home to Little Rock to view tornado damage in my old neighborhood, including the loss of several old trees on the grounds of the governor's mansion. A visit to St. Louis to welcome Pope John Paul II back to the United States. A meeting with a large bipartisan congressional delegation in the East Room to discuss the future of Social Security and Medicare, and a memorial service for my friend Governor Lawton Childs of Florida, who had died suddenly not long before. Lawton had given me courage for the current fight with one of his favorite sayings, "If you can't run with the big dogs, you ought to stay on the porch." On February 7th, King Hussein lost his fight against cancer. Hillary and I immediately left for Jordan with a delegation that included Presidents Ford, Carter, and Bush. I was very grateful for their willingness on short notice to honor a man we had all worked with and admired. The next day we walked in his funeral procession for almost a mile, attended the memorial service, and paid our respects to Queen Noor, who was heartbroken. So were Hillary and I. We had enjoyed some wonderful times with Hussein and Noor in Jordan and in the United States. I remembered with particular pleasure a meal the four of us had shared on the Truman balcony of the White House not long before the King died. Now he was gone, and the world was a poorer place. After meetings with the new monarch, Hussein's son, Abdullah, as well as Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Assad, President Mubarak, Tony Blair, Jacques Chirac, Boris Yeltsin, and President Süleyman Demirel of Turkey, I flew home to await the Senate vote on my future. Though the outcome wasn't in doubt, the behind-the-scenes maneuvering had been interesting. Several Republican senators were upset with the House Republicans for putting them through the trial, but whenever the right wing turned the pressure up, most of them backed down and went along with dragging the whole thing out. When Senator Robert Byrd moved to have the charges dismissed as having no merit, David Kendall's partner, Nicole Seligman, made an argument on the law and the facts that most senators knew was undebatable. Nevertheless, Byrd's motion was defeated. When Senator Strom Thurmond told his Republican colleagues early on that the votes weren't there to remove me and the process should be stopped, he was overruled in the Republican caucus. One Republican senator who was opposed to impeachment kept us informed of what was going on among his colleagues. Several days before the vote, he said there were only 30 Republican votes for the perjury count and 40 to 45 for the obstruction of justice count. They were nowhere near the two-thirds majority the Constitution requires for removal. A few days before the vote, the senator told us that the House Republicans had said they would be humiliated if neither count got at least a token majority of the votes, and their Senate colleagues had better not humiliate them if they wanted the House to stay in Republican hands after the next election. The senator reported that they would have to whittle the number of Republican no votes down. On February 12th, the impeachment motions failed. The vote on the perjury count failed by 22 votes, 45 to 55, and the vote on the obstruction of justice count failed by 17 votes, 50 to 50, with all the Democrats and Republican senators, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins of Maine, Jim Jeffords of Vermont, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, and John Chaffee of Rhode Island voting no on both counts. Senators Richard Shelby of Alabama, Slade Gorton of Washington, Ted Stevens of Alaska, Fred Thompson of Tennessee, and John Warner of Virginia voted no on the perjury count. The vote itself was anticlimactic, coming 3 weeks after the close of my defense. Only the margin of defeat was in doubt. I was just glad the ordeal was over for my family and my country. After the vote, I said that I was profoundly sorry for what I had done to trigger the events and the great burden they imposed on the American people, and that I was rededicating myself to a time of reconciliation and renewal for America. I took one question. "In your heart, sir, can you forgive and forget?" I replied, I believe any person who asks for forgiveness has to be prepared to give it. After the impeachment ordeal, people often ask me how I got through it without losing my mind, or at least the ability to keep doing the job. I couldn't have done it if the White House staff and cabinet, including those who were angry and disappointed over my conduct, hadn't stayed with me. It would have been much harder if the American people hadn't made an early judgment that I should remain president and stuck with it. If more congressional Democrats had bailed out when it looked like the safe thing to do in January, after the story broke, or in August after I testified to the grand jury, it would have been tough. Instead, they rose to the challenge. Having the support of world leaders like Mandela, Blair, King Hussein, Havel, Crown Prince Abdullah, Kim Dae-jung, Chirac, Cardoso, Zedillah, and others whom I admired helped to keep my spirits up. When I compared them with my enemies, as disgusted as I still was with myself, I figured I couldn't be all bad. The love and support of friends and strangers made a big difference. Those who wrote to me or said a kind word in a crowd meant more than they will ever know. The religious leaders who counseled me, visited me at the White House, or called to pray with me reminded me that notwithstanding the condemnations I had received from some quarters, God is love. But the biggest factors in my ability to survive and function were personal. Hillary's brothers and my brother were wonderfully supported. Roger joked to me that it was nice to finally be the brother who wasn't in trouble. Hugh came up from Miami every week to play upwards, talk sports, and make me laugh. Tony came over for our family pinochle matches. My mother-in-law and Dick Kelly were great to me. Despite everything, our daughter still loved me and wanted me to stand my ground. And most important, Hillary stood with me and loved me through it all. From the time we first met, I had loved her laugh. In the midst of all the absurdity, we were laughing again, brought back together by our weekly counseling and our shared determination to fight off the right-wing coup. I almost wound up being grateful to my tormentors. They were probably the only people who could have made me look good to Hillary again. I even got off the couch. During the long year between the deposition in the Jones case and my acquittal in the Senate, on most of the nights when I was home in the White House, I spent 2 to 3 hours alone in my office reading the Bible and books on faith and forgiveness, and rereading The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, and several of the most thoughtful letters I had received, including a series of mini-sermons from Rabbi Menachem Ganach of Englewood, New Jersey. I was particularly affected by 70x7, a book about forgiveness by Johann Christoph Arnold, the elder of Bruderhof, a Christian community with members in the northeastern United States and in England. I still have poems, prayers, and quotations that people sent me or put in my hand at public events. And I have 2 stones with the New Testament verse John 8:7 inscribed on them. In what many people believe was Jesus' last encounter with his critics, the Pharisees, they brought to him a woman caught in the act of adultery and said the law of Moses commanded them to stone her to death. They taunted Jesus, "What sayest thou?" Instead of answering, Jesus leaned over and wrote on the ground with his finger, as if he had not heard them. When they continued to ask, he stood and said, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." Those who heard him, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest even unto the last. When Jesus was alone with the woman, he asked her, "Where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee?" She answered, "No man, Lord." And Jesus replied, "Neither do I condemn thee." I had had a lot of stones cast at me, and through my own self-inflicted wounds I had been exposed to the whole world. In some ways it was liberating. I had nothing more to hide, and as I tried to understand why I had made my own mistakes, I also attempted to figure out why my adversaries were so consumed with hatred and so willing to say and do things inconsistent with their professed moral convictions. I had always looked with a jaundiced eye at other people's attempts to psychoanalyze me, but it did seem to me that many of my bitterest critics among the far-right political and religious groups and the most judgmental members of the press had sought safety and security in positions where they could judge and not be judged, hurt and not be hurt. My sense of my own mortality and human frailty and the unconditional love I'd had as a child had spared me the compulsion to judge and condemn others. And I believed my personal flaws, no matter how deep, were far less threatening to our democratic government than the power lust of my accusers. In late January, I had received a moving letter from Bill Ziff of New York, a businessman I'd never met but whose son was a friend of mine. He said that he was sorry for the pain Hillary and I had endured, but that much good had come of it, because the American people had shown maturity and judgment in seeing through the demonizing mullahs in our midst. Though it was never your intention, you have done more to expose their underlying agenda than any president in history, including Roosevelt. Whatever the motives of my adversaries, it became clear on those solitary nights in my upstairs office that if I wanted compassion from others, I needed to show it, even to those who didn't respond in kind. Besides, what did I have to complain about? I would never be a perfect person, but Hillary was laughing again. Chelsea was still doing well at Stanford. I was still doing a job I loved, and spring was on the way. Chapter 52. On February 19th, a week after the Senate vote, I gave the first posthumous pardon ever granted by a president to Henry Flipper, the first black graduate of West Point who, because of his race, had been wrongfully convicted of conduct unbecoming an officer 117 years earlier. Such actions by a president may seem unimportant compared with the power of current events, but correcting historical mistakes matters, not only to the descendants of those who were wronged, but to us all. In the last week of the month, Paul Begala announced his departure from the White House. I had relished having Paul there, because he had been with me since New Hampshire, and he was smart, funny, combative, and effective. He also had small children who deserved more time with their father. Paul had stuck with me through the impeachment battle. Now he needed to leave. The only news out of Whitewater World was the lopsided vote of the American Bar Association, 384-49, on a resolution calling for the repeal of the independent counsel law, and a news report saying the Justice Department was investigating whether Kenneth Starr had deceived Janet Reno about his office's involvement with the Jones case and about the reasons he gave her for adding the Lewinsky matter to his jurisdiction. March began with the announcement that after months of complex negotiations, the administration had succeeded in preserving the largest unprotected stand of old-growth redwoods in the world, the Headwaters Forest in Northern California. The next week I took a 4-day trip to Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala to highlight a new era of democratic cooperation in a region in which, not long before, America had supported repressive regimes with horrible human rights records as long as they were anti-communist. Viewing the aftermath of natural disasters that American troops were helping with, speaking to the parliament in El Salvador, where recent adversaries in a bloody civil war now sat together in peace, apologizing for America's past actions in Guatemala, all these seemed to me to be signs of a new era of democratic progress I was committed to support. By the time I returned, we were moving toward another Balkan war, this time in Kosovo. The Serbs had launched an offensive against rebellious Kosovar Albanians a year earlier, killing many innocent people. Some women and children were burned in their own homes. The last round of Serb aggression had sparked another exodus of refugees and had increased the desire of Kosovar Albanians for independence. The killings were all too reminiscent of the early days of Bosnia, which, like Kosovo, bridged the divide between European Muslims and Serb Orthodox Christians, a dividing line along which there had been conflict from time to time for 600 years. In 1974, Tito had given Kosovo autonomy, allowing it self-government and control over its schools. In 1989, Milosevic had taken autonomy away. The tensions had been rising ever since and had exploded after the independence of Bosnia was secured in 1995. I was determined not to allow Kosovo to become another Bosnia. So was Madeleine Albright. By April 1998, the United Nations had imposed an arms embargo, and the United States and its allies had imposed economic sanctions on Serbia for its failure to end the hostilities and begin a dialogue with Kosovar Albanians. By the middle of June, NATO had begun to plan for a range of military options to end the violence. As summer came, Dick Holbrooke was back in the region to try to find a diplomatic solution for the standoff. In mid-July, Serb forces again attacked armed and unarmed Kosovars, beginning a summer of aggression that would force 300,000 more Kosovar Albanians to leave their homes. In late September, the UN Security Council had passed another resolution demanding an end to hostilities, and at month's end, we sent Holbrooke on yet another mission to Belgrade to try to reason with Milosevic. On October 13th, NATO had threatened to attack Serbia within 4 days unless the UN resolutions were observed. The airstrikes were delayed when 4,000 Yugoslav special police officers were withdrawn from Kosovo. Things got better for a while, but in January 1999, the Serbs were killing innocents in Kosovo again, and NATO airstrikes seemed inevitable. We decided to try diplomacy one more time, but I wasn't optimistic. The parties' objectives were far apart. The United States and NATO wanted Kosovo to have the political autonomy it had enjoyed under the Yugoslav Constitution between 1974 and 1989, until Milosevic took it away. And we wanted a NATO-led peacekeeping force to guarantee the peace and the safety of Kosovo's civilians, including the Serb minority. Milosevic wanted to keep control of Kosovo and was opposed to any foreign troop deployments there. The Kosovar Albanians wanted independence. They were also divided among themselves. Ibrahim Rugova, the head of the shadow government, was a soft-spoken man with a penchant for wearing a scarf round his neck. I was convinced we could make a peace agreement with him, but not so sure about the other main Kosovar faction, the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA, led by a young man named Hashim Thaci. The KLA wanted independence and believed it could actually go toe-to-toe with the Serbian army. The parties met at Rambouillet, France, on February 6 to work out the details of an agreement that would restore autonomy, protect the Kosovars from oppression with a NATO-led operation, disarm the KLA, and allow the Serb army to continue to patrol the border. Madeleine Albright and her British counterpart, Robin Cook, pursued this policy aggressively. After a week of negotiations coordinated by U.S. Ambassador Chris Hill and his counterparts from the European Union and Russia, Madeleine found that our position was opposed by both sides. The Serbs didn't want to agree to a NATO peacekeeping force, and the Kosovars didn't want to agree to accept autonomy unless they were also guaranteed a referendum on independence. And the KLA weren't happy about having to disarm, partly because they weren't sure they could rely on the NATO forces to protect them. Our team decided to write the agreement in a way that would delay the referendum, but not deny it forever. On February 23rd, the Kosovar Albanians, including Thaci, accepted the agreement in principle, returned home to sell it to their people, and in mid-March traveled to Paris to sign the finished document. The Serbs boycotted the ceremony as 40,000 Serbian troops massed in and around Kosovo, and Milosevic said again that he would never agree to foreign troops on Yugoslavian soil. I sent Dick Holbrooke back to see him one last time, but even Dick couldn't budge him. On March 23rd, after Holbrooke left Belgrade, NATO Secretary General Javier Solana, with my full support, directed General Wes Clark to begin airstrikes. On the same day, by a bipartisan majority of 58-41, the Senate voted to support the action. Earlier in the month, the House had voted 219-191 to support sending U.S. troops to Kosovo if there was a peace agreement. Among the prominent Republicans voting for the proposal were the new Speaker Dennis Hastert and Henry Hyde. When Congressman Hyde said America should stand up against Milosevic and ethnic cleansing, I smiled and thought to myself that maybe Dr. Jekyll was in there somewhere after all. While a majority of Congress and all our NATO allies favored the airstrikes, Russia did not. Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov was on his way to the United States to meet with Al Gore. When Al notified him that a NATO attack on Yugoslavia was imminent, Primakov ordered his plane to turn around and take him back to Moscow. On the 24th, I spoke to the American people about what I was doing and why. I explained that Milosevic had stripped the Kosovars of their autonomy, denying them their constitutionally guaranteed rights to speak their own language, run their own schools, and govern themselves. I described the Serb atrocities, killing civilians, burning villages, and driving people from their homes, 60,000 in the last 5 weeks, 250,000 in all. Finally, I put the current events in the context of the wars Milosevic had already waged against Bosnia and Croatia, and the destructive impact of his killing on the future of Europe. The bombing campaign had three objectives: to show Milosevic we were serious about stopping another round of ethnic cleansing, to deter an even bloodier offensive against innocent civilians in Kosovo, and if Milosevic didn't throw in the towel soon, to seriously damage the Serbs' military capacity. That night, the NATO airstrikes began. They would last for 11 weeks as Milosevic continued to kill Kosovar Albanians and drive almost 1 million people from their homes. The bombs would inflict great damage on the military and economic infrastructure of Serbia. Alas, on a few occasions they would miss their intended targets and take the lives of people we were trying to protect. Some people argued that our position would have been more defensible if we had sent in ground troops. There were two problems with that argument. First, by the time the soldiers were in position in adequate numbers and with proper support, the Serbs would have done an enormous amount of damage. Second, the civilian casualties of a ground campaign would probably have been greater than the toll from errant bombs. I didn't find the argument that I should pursue a course that would cost more American lives without enhancing the prospect of victory very persuasive. Our strategy would often be second-guessed, but never abandoned. At the end of the month, as the stock market closed above 10,000 for the first time ever, up from 3,200 when I took office, I sat down for an interview with CBS TV's Dan Rather. After an extended discussion of Kosovo, Dan asked me whether I expected to be the husband of a United States senator. By then, many New York officials had joined Charlie Rangel in asking Hillary to consider the race. I told Rather that I had no idea what she would do, but if she ran and won, she would be magnificent. In April, the Kosovo conflict intensified as we extended the bombing to downtown Belgrade, hitting the Interior Ministry, Serbia's state television headquarters, and Milosevic's party headquarters and his home. We also dramatically increased our financial support and troop presence in neighboring Albania and Macedonia to help them deal with the large number of refugees flooding in. By the end of the month, when Milosevic still hadn't folded, opposition to our policy was coming from both directions. Tony Blair and some members of Congress thought it was time to send in ground troops, while the House of Representatives voted to deny the use of troops without prior approval of Congress. I still believed the air campaign would work and hoped we could avoid sending ground troops until their mission was to keep the peace. On April 14th, I called Boris Yeltsin to request Russian troop participation in a post-conflict peacekeeping force, as in Bosnia. I thought a Russian presence would help protect the Serb minority and might give Milosevic a face-saving way out of his opposition to foreign troops. A lot of other things happened in April. On the 5th, Libya finally handed over two suspects in the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. They would be tried before Scottish judges in The Hague. The White House had been deeply involved in the issue for years. I had pressed the Libyans to do it, and the White House had reached out to the families of victims, keeping them informed and approving the construction of a memorial to their loved ones in Arlington National Cemetery. It was the beginning of a thaw in U.S.-Libyan relations. In the second week of the month, Chinese Premier Zhu Rongji made his first trip to the White House in the hope of resolving the remaining obstacles to China's entry into the World Trade Organization. We had made substantial progress in closing the gaps between us, but problems remained, including our desire for greater access to China's auto market and China's insistence on a 5-year limit for our surge agreement, under which the United States could limit a sudden large increase in Chinese imports when it occurred for other than normal economic reasons. It was an important issue in America because of the surge we had experienced in imported steel from Russia, Japan, and elsewhere. Charlene Barshefsky told me that the Chinese had moved a long way, and we should close the deal while Zhu was in the United States to avoid weakening him at home. Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger agreed with her. The rest of the economic team, Rubin, Summers, Sperling, and Daly, along with John Podesta and my legislative aide, Larry Stein, disagreed. They thought that without more progress, Congress would reject the deal and kill China's entry into the WTO. I met with Zhu in the Yellow Oval Room the night before the start of his official visit. I told him frankly that my advisors were split, but that we would work all night if it was important to have the deal done while he was in the United States. Zhu said if the timing was bad, we could wait. Unfortunately, the false story that we had a deal leaked, so that when it didn't happen, Zhu was hurt for the concessions he had made, and I was criticized as having turned away a good agreement under pressure from the opponents of China's entry into the WTO. The story was reinforced by a spate of anti-China stories circulating in the media. The allegations that the Chinese government had steered funds into the 1996 campaign had not been resolved, and Wen-Ho Lee, a Chinese-American employee of our National Energy Lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico, had been accused of stealing sensitive technology for China. All of my team wanted China in the WTO this year. Now it was going to be harder to achieve. On April 12th, a jury rendered its verdict in Kenneth Starr's case against Susan McDougal, who had been charged with obstruction of justice and criminal contempt for her continued refusal to testify before the grand jury. She was acquitted on the obstruction of justice charge, and according to press reports, the jury deadlocked 7-5 for acquittal on the contempt charges. It was an amazing verdict. McDougal admitted that she had refused a court order to testify because she didn't trust Starr and his chief deputy, Hick Ewing. She testified that now, in open court, she would be glad to answer any questions that the OIC had wanted to ask in the secret grand jury proceedings. She said that even though she had been offered immunity, she had refused to cooperate with the OIC because Starr and his staff had repeatedly tried to get her to lie to incriminate Hillary or me, and she believed that if she testified truthfully before the grand jury, he would indict her for her refusal to lie. To close her defense, she called Julie Hyatt Steele, who testified that Starr had done exactly that to her, indicting her after she twice refused to lie for him in a grand jury proceeding. The victory couldn't give Susan McDougal her lost years back, but her vindication was a stunning setback for Starr and a sweet triumph for all the other people whose lives and savings he had destroyed. On the 20th, America suffered another horrible school shooting. At Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, two heavily armed students opened fire on their classmates, killing 12 students and injuring more than 20 others before turning their guns on themselves. It could have been even worse. One teacher who later died from his wounds led many students to safety. Medics and police officers saved more lives. A week later, with a bipartisan group of members of Congress and mayors, I announced some measures to make it harder for guns to fall into the wrong hands, applying the Brady Law's prohibition on gun ownership to violent juveniles, closing the gun show loophole to require background checks on people who bought guns at such events rather than at gun stores, cracking down on illegal gun trafficking, and prohibiting juveniles from owning assault rifles. I also proposed funds to help schools develop successful violence prevention and conflict resolution programs, like the one I had observed at T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott called my initiative a typical knee-jerk reaction, and Tom DeLay accused me of exploiting Columbine for political gain. But the legislation's principal sponsor, Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy of New York, wasn't interested in politics. Her husband had been killed and her son badly wounded on a commuter train by a deranged man with a handgun he should never have been able to possess. The NRA and its supporters blamed our violent culture. I agreed that children were exposed to too much violence. That's why I was supporting Al and Tipper Gore's drive to get V-chips into new TVs so that parents could limit children's exposure to excessive violence. But the violence in our culture only strengthened the argument for doing more to keep guns away from children, criminals, and mentally unstable people. At the end of the month, Hillary and I hosted the largest gathering of heads of state ever to meet in Washington, as the leaders of NATO and the states in its Partnership for Peace gathered to celebrate the 50th anniversary of NATO and to reaffirm our determination to prevail in Kosovo. Afterward, Al Fromm of the DLC and Sidney Blumenthal put together another of our third-way conferences to highlight the values, ideas, and strategies Tony Blair and I shared with Gerhard Schroeder of Germany, Wim Kok of the Netherlands, and the new Italian Prime Minister, Massimo D'Alema. By this time, I was focused on building a global consensus on economic, social, and security policies that I thought would serve America and the world well when my term was over, by strengthening the forces of positive interdependence and weakening those of disintegration and destruction. The Third Way movement and the broadening of NATO's alliance and its mission had moved us a fair distance in the right direction, but as with so many of the best-laid plans, they would later be overtaken and redirected by events, principally the growing hostility to globalization and the rising tide of terror. In early May, shortly after Jesse Jackson persuaded Milosevic to release three U.S. servicemen the Serbs had captured along their border with Macedonia, we lost two American soldiers when their Apache helicopter crashed in a training exercise. They would be the only U.S. casualties in the conflict. Boris Yeltsin sent Viktor Chernomyrdin to see me to discuss Russia's interest in ending the war and its apparent willingness to participate in the peacekeeping force afterward. Meanwhile, we kept the pressure up as I authorized 176 more aircraft for Wes Clark. On May 7th, we suffered the worst political setback of the conflict when NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, killing three Chinese citizens. I soon learned that the bombs had hit their intended target, which had been erroneously identified on the basis of old CIA maps as a Serbian government building used for military purposes. It was the kind of mistake we had worked hard to avoid. The military was mostly using aerial photography for targeting. I had begun meeting with Bill Cohen, Hugh Shelton, and Sandy Berger several times a week to go over the high-profile targets in an attempt to maximize damage to Milosevic's aggression while minimizing civilian casualties. I was dumbfounded and deeply upset by the mistake and immediately called Jiang Zemin to apologize. He wouldn't take the call, so I publicly and repeatedly apologized. Over the next 3 days, protests escalated all over China. They were especially intense around the American embassy in Beijing, where Ambassador Sasser found himself besieged. The Chinese said they believed the attack was deliberate and declined to accept my apologies. When I finally talked with President Jiang on the 14th, I apologized again and told him I was sure he didn't believe I would knowingly attack his embassy. Jiang replied that he knew I wouldn't do that, but said he did believe that there were people in the Pentagon or the CIA who didn't favor my outreach to China and could have rigged the maps intentionally to cause a rift between us. Zhang had a hard time believing that a nation as technologically advanced as we were could make such a mistake. I had a hard time believing it too, but that's what happened. Eventually we got beyond it, but it was tough going for a while. I had just named Admiral Joe Preer, who was retiring as Commander-in-Chief of the Forces in the Pacific, to be the new U.S. Ambassador to China. He was very respected by the Chinese military, and I believed he would be able to help repair the relationship. By late May, NATO had approved a 48,000-troop peacekeeping force to go into Kosovo after the conflict was concluded, and we had begun quiet discussions about the possibility of sending in ground troops earlier if it became clear that the air campaign wasn't going to prevail before people were trapped in the mountains by winter. Sandy Berger was preparing a memo for me on options, and I was ready to send troops in if necessary. But I still believed the air war would succeed. On the 27th, Milosevic was indicted by the war crimes prosecutor in The Hague. There was a great deal of activity in the rest of the world in May. In mid-month, Boris Yeltsin survived his own impeachment vote in the Duma. On the 17th, Prime Minister Netanyahu was defeated for re-election by the Labour Party leader, retired General Ehud Barak, the most decorated soldier in Israeli history. Barak was a brilliant Renaissance man. He had done graduate work in economic engineering systems at Stanford. He was a concert-level classical pianist and repaired clocks as a hobby. He had been in politics only a few years, and his close-cropped hair, intense stare, and blunt staccato speaking style were more reflective of his military past than of the more murky political waters he now had to navigate. His victory was a clear signal that Israelis saw in him what they had seen in his role model, Yitzhak Rabin: the possibility of peace with security. Equally important, Barak's large victory margin had given him the chance to have a governing coalition in the Knesset that would support the hard steps to peace, something Prime Minister Netanyahu had never had. The next day, Jordan's King Abdullah came to see me, full of hope for peace and determination to be a worthy successor to his father. He clearly understood the challenges facing his nation and the peace process. I was also struck by his understanding of economics and the contribution that more growth could make to peace and reconciliation. After the meeting, I was convinced that the king and his equally impressive wife, Queen Rania, would be positive forces in the region for a long time to come. On May 26, Bill Perry delivered a letter from me to Kim Jong-il, North Korea's leader, proposing a roadmap to the future in which America would provide a broad range of assistance to him if, but only if, he gave up his attempts to develop nuclear weapons and long-range missiles. In 1998, North Korea had taken the constructive step of ending its tests of such missiles, and I thought Perry's mission had a fair chance to succeed. 2 days later, Hillary and I were at a DLC retreat at White Oak Plantation in northern Florida, which has the largest wild game preserve in the United States. I got up at 4 a.m. to watch the inaugural ceremonies of Nigeria's new president, former General Olusegun Obasanjo, on TV. Ever since gaining independence, Nigeria had been riddled by corruption, regional and religious strife, and deteriorating social conditions. Despite its large oil production, the country suffered periodic power outages and fuel shortages. Obasanjo had taken power briefly in a military coup in the 1970s, then had kept his promise to step aside as soon as new elections could be held. Later, he had been imprisoned for his political views and, while incarcerated, had become a devout Christian and had written books about his faith. It was hard to imagine a bright future for sub-Saharan Africa without a more successful Nigeria, by far its most populous nation. After listening to his compelling inaugural address, I hoped Obasanjo would be able to succeed where others had failed. On the home front, I started the month with an important clean air announcement. We had already reduced toxic air pollution from chemical plants by 90% and had set tough standards to reduce smog and soot that would prevent millions of cases of childhood asthma. On May 1st, I said that after extensive consultation with industry, environmental, and consumer groups, EPA Administrator Carol Browner would promulgate a rule to require all passenger vehicles, including gas-guzzling SUVs, to meet the same pollution standards, and that we would cut the sulfur content of gasoline by 90% over 5 years. I announced a new crime initiative, releasing the funds to complete our efforts to put 100,000 police on the streets. More than half of them were already in service. Expanding the COPS program to hire 50,000 more police officers in the highest crime areas, and making it a federal crime to possess biological agents that could be turned into terrorist weapons without a legitimate, peaceful purpose for having them. The 12th was a day I had hoped would never come. Bob Rubin was returning to private life. I believed he had been the best and most important Treasury Secretary since Alexander Hamilton in the early days of our republic. Bob had also been the first head of the National Economic Council. In both positions, he had played a decisive role in our efforts to restore economic growth and spread its benefits to more Americans, to prevent and contain financial crisis abroad, and to modernize the international financial system to deal with a global economy in which more than $1 trillion crossed national borders every day. He had also been a rock of stability during the impeachment ordeal, not only speaking up at the meeting when I apologized to my cabinet, but also constantly reminding our people that they should be proud of what they were doing and cautioning them not to be too judgmental. One of our younger people said that Bob had told him that if he lived long enough, he would do something he'd be ashamed of, too. When Bob came into the administration, he was probably the wealthiest person on our team. After he supported the 1993 economic plan with its tax increase for the highest income Americans, I used to joke that Bob Rubin came to Washington to help me save the middle class, and when he leaves, he'll be one of them. Now that Bob was moving back into private life, I didn't think I'd have to worry about that anymore. I named Bob's able deputy secretary, Larry Summers, to succeed him. Larry had been in the thick of all the major economic questions of the last 6 years, and he was ready. I also named Stu Eisenstadt, the Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, to be Deputy Treasury Secretary. Stu had handled a lot of important assignments well, none more important than the so-called Nazi gold matter. Edgar Bronfman Sr. had sparked our interest in it by contacting Hillary, who got things moving with an initial meeting. Eisenstadt then spearheaded our attempt to secure justice and compensation for Holocaust survivors and their families whose assets had been looted as they were being packed off to concentration camps. Soon afterward, Hillary and I flew to Colorado to meet with students and families from Columbine High School. A few days earlier, the Senate had adopted my proposals to ban the import of large ammunition clips that were being used to evade the assault weapons ban, and to ban the possession of assault weapons by juveniles. And in the face of intense lobbying by the NRA, Al Gore had broken a 50-50 tie to pass the proposal to close the gun show loophole in the Brady Law's requirement of background checks. Although the community was still grieving, the students at Columbine were coming back, and they and their parents seemed determined to do something to reduce the chances of further Columbines. They knew that though there had been several school shootings before theirs, it was Columbine that had finally pierced the soul of America. I told them that they could help America build a safer future because of what they had endured. Although Congress would not close the gun show loophole, in the 2000 election because of Columbine, the voters in conservative Colorado would pass a measure to do so in their state by an overwhelming margin. Whitewater World was still alive and well in May, as Kenneth Starr, despite his defeat in the Susan McDougall trial, pursued his case against Julie Hyatt Steele. The case ended in a hung jury. In conservative Northern Virginia, it was another setback for the independent counsel and his tactics. After all Starr's efforts to get into the Jones case, the only person who was indicted as a result was Steele, another innocent bystander who refused to lie. Starr's office had now conducted 4 trials and lost 3. In June, the punishing bombing raids on the Serbs finally broke Milosevic's will to resist. On the 2nd, Viktor Chernomyrdin and Finnish President Martti Ahtisaari personally handled NATO's demands to Milosevic. The next day, Milosevic and the Serbian parliament agreed to them. Predictably, the next few days were full of tension and disputes over the details. But on the 9th, NATO and Serbian military officials agreed to a prompt withdrawal of Serb forces from Kosovo and the deployment of an international security force with a unified NATO chain of command. The next day, Javier Solana instructed General Clark to suspend NATO's air operations. The UN Security Council passed a resolution welcoming the end of the war, and I announced to the American people that after 79 days, the bombing campaign was over, the Serb forces were withdrawing, and the 1 million men, women, and children driven from their land would be able to go home. In an Oval Office address to the nation, I thanked our armed forces for their superb performance and the American people for their stand against ethnic cleansing and their generous support of the refugees, many of whom had come to America. Allied Commander Wes Clark had managed the campaign with skill and determination, and he and Javier Solana had done yeoman's work in holding the alliance together and in never wavering in our steadfast commitment to victory on the bad days as well as the good ones. So had my entire national security team. Even though when the bombing wasn't over in a week, we were constantly second-guessed, Bill Cohen and Hugh Shelton had remained convinced that the air campaign would work if we could hold the coalition together for 2 months. Al Gore, Madeleine Albright, and Sandy Berger had all remained cool under fire in the nail-biting roller coaster weeks we had just been through together. Al had played a critical role in keeping our relationship with Russia intact by staying in contact with Viktor Chernomyrdin and making sure that we and the Russians had a common position when Chernomyrdin and Ahtisaari went to Serbia to try to persuade Milosevic to give up his futile resistance. On the 11th, I took a congressional delegation to Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri to say a special word of thanks to the crews and support personnel on B-2 stealth bombers, which flew all the way from Missouri to Serbia and back, non-stop, to perform the nighttime bombing operations for which the B-2 was especially well-suited. In all, 30,000 sorties were flown in the Kosovo campaign. Only 2 planes were lost, and their crews were recovered safely. After the raid succeeded, John Keegan, perhaps the foremost living historian of warfare, wrote a fascinating article in the British press about the Kosovo campaign. He admitted frankly that he had not believed the bombing would work and that he had been wrong. He said the reason such campaigns had failed in the past is that most bombs had missed their targets. The weaponry used in Kosovo was more precise than that used in the first Gulf War. And though some bombs went astray in Kosovo and Serbia, far fewer civilians were killed than in Iraq. I'm also still convinced that fewer civilians died than would have perished if we had put in ground troops, a bridge I would nevertheless have crossed rather than let Milosevic prevail. The success of the air campaign in Kosovo marked a new chapter in military history. There was one more tense moment before things settled down. 2 days after hostilities officially ended, 50 vehicles carrying about 200 Russian troops rushed into Kosovo from Bosnia and occupied the Pristina airport without advance agreement from NATO, 4 hours before the NATO troops authorized by the UN arrived. The Russians asserted their intention to keep control of the airport. Wes Clark was livid. I didn't blame him, but I knew we weren't on the verge of World War III. Yeltsin was getting a lot of criticism at home for cooperating with us from ultranationalists whose sympathies lay with the Serbs. I thought he was just throwing them a temporary bone. Soon the British commander, Lieutenant General Michael Jackson, resolved the situation without incident, and on June 18th, Secretary Cohen and the Russian defense minister reached an agreement under which Russian troops would join the UN-sanctioned NATO forces in Kosovo. On June 20th, the Yugoslav military completed its withdrawal, and just 2 weeks later, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees estimated that more than 765,000 refugees had already returned to Kosovo. As we had learned from our experience in Bosnia, even after the conflict, there would still be a great deal of work ahead in Kosovo, getting the refugees home safely, clearing the minefields, rebuilding homes, providing food, medicine, and shelter to the homeless, demilitarizing the Kosovo Liberation Army, creating a secure environment for both Kosovar Albanians and the minority Serb population, organizing a civilian administration, and restoring a functioning economy. It was a big job, most of which would be performed by our European allies, even as America had borne the lion's share of responsibility for the air war. Despite the challenges ahead, I felt an enormous sense of relief and satisfaction. Slobodan Milosevic's bloody 10-year campaign to exploit ethnic and religious differences in order to impose his will on the former Yugoslavia was on its last legs. The burning of villages and killing of innocents was history. I knew it was just a matter of time before Milosevic was history, too. On the day we reached the agreement with Russia, Hillary and I were in Cologne, Germany, for the annual G8 summit. It turned out to be one of the most important such meetings of my entire 8 years. In addition to celebrating the successful end to the Kosovo conflict, we endorsed our finance minister's recommendations to modernize the international financial institutions and our national policies to meet the challenges of the global economy, and we announced a proposal, which I strongly supported, for a massive millennium debt relief initiative for poor countries if they agreed to put all the savings into education, health care, or economic development. The initiative was consistent with a chorus of calls for debt relief from all over the world, led by Pope John Paul II and my friend Bono. After the summit, we flew on to Slovenia to thank the Slovenians for supporting NATO in Kosovo and helping the refugees, then to Macedonia, where President Kiro Gligorov, despite his country's own economic hardships and ethnic tensions, had taken in 300,000 refugees. At the camp in Skopje, Hillary, Chelsea, and I got to visit with some of them and hear the horrible stories of what they had endured. We also met members of the International Security Force who were stationed there. It was my first chance to thank Wes Clark in person. Politics began to heat up in June. Al Gore announced for president on the 16th. His likely opponent was Governor George W. Bush, the preferred candidate of both the Republican Party's right wing and its establishment. Bush had already raised more money than Al and his primary opponent, former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley, combined. Hillary was moving closer to getting into the Senate race in New York. By the time we left the White House, she would have helped me in my political career for more than 26 years. I was more than happy to support her for the next 26. As we entered the political season, I was far more concerned about maintaining the momentum for action in Congress and in my own government. Traditionally, when presidential politics begin to heat up and the president isn't part of it, inertia sets in. Some of the Democrats thought they would be better off if little new legislation was passed. Then they could run against a Republican do-nothing Congress. Many Republicans just didn't want to give me any more victories. I was surprised at how bitter some of them still seemed to be 4 months after the impeachment battle, especially since I hadn't been hammering them in public or in private. I tried to wake up every morning without bitterness and to keep working in a spirit of reconciliation. The Republicans seemed to have reverted to the theme that they had trumpeted since 1992. I was a person without character who could not be trusted. During the Kosovo conflict, some Republicans almost seemed to be rooting for us to fail. One Republican senator justified his colleagues' tepid support for what our troops were doing by saying, "I had lost their trust." They were blaming me for their own failure to oppose ethnic cleansing. It seemed to me that the Republicans were trying to put me in a lose-lose situation. If I went around wearing a hair shirt, they would say I was too damaged to lead. If I was happy, they would say I was gloating and acting as if I'd gotten away with something. 6 days after my acquittal in the Senate, I had gone to New Hampshire to celebrate the 7th anniversary of my New Hampshire primary. Some of my congressional critics said I shouldn't have been happy, but I was happy. And for good reasons, all my old friends came out to see me. I met a young man who said he had cast his first vote for me, and I had done exactly what I had said I would do. And I met a woman who said I had inspired her to get off welfare and go back to school to become a nurse. By 1999, she was a member of the New Hampshire Board of Nursing. Those were the people I got into politics for. At first, I couldn't for the life of me figure out how the Republicans and some commentators could say I'd gotten away with anything. The public humiliation, the pain to my family, the huge debts from legal bills and settling the Jones suit after I'd won it, the years of press and legal abuse Hillary had endured, and the helplessness I felt as countless innocent people in Washington and Arkansas were persecuted and ruined financially. These things took a terrible toll on me. I had apologized and tried to demonstrate my sincerity in the way I'd treated and worked with the Republicans. But none of it was enough. It would never be enough, for one simple reason. I had survived and continued to serve and fight for what I believed. First, last, and always, my struggle with the new right Republicans was about power. I thought power came from the people, and they should give it and take it away. They thought the people had made a mistake in electing me twice, and they were determined to use my personal mistakes to justify their continuing assault. I was sure that my more positive strategy was the right thing for me as a person and for my ability to do my job. I wasn't as sure it was good politics. The more the Republicans pounded away at me, the more the memories of what Ken Starr had done or how they had behaved during impeachment faded. The press is naturally focused on today's story, not yesterday's, and conflict makes news. That tends to reward the aggressor, whether the underlying attack is fair or not. Soon, instead of asking me whether I could forgive and forget, the press was asking those earnest-sounding questions again about whether I had the moral authority to lead. The Republicans were barking away at Hillary, too, now that instead of being a sympathetic figure standing by her flawed man, she was a strong woman finding her own way in politics. Yet, on balance, I still felt good about where things stood. The country was moving in the right direction, my job rating was high, and we still had plenty to do. Although I would always regret what I had done wrong, I will go to my grave being proud of what I had fought for in the impeachment battle, my last great showdown with the forces I had opposed all my life. Those who had defended the old order of racial discrimination and segregation in the South and played on the insecurities and fears of the white working class in which I grew up. Who had opposed the women's movement, the environmental movement, the gay rights movement, and other efforts to expand our national community as assaults on the natural order. Who believed government should be run for the benefit of powerful entrenched interests and favored tax cuts for the wealthy over health care and better education for children. Ever since I was a boy, I had been on the other side. At first, the forces of reaction, division, and the status quo were represented by anti-civil rights Democrats. When the National Party under Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson began to embrace the cause of civil rights, the Southern conservatives migrated to the Republican Party, which beginning in the 1970s formed an alliance with the rising religious right-wing movement. When the new right Republicans had taken power in Congress in 1995, I had blocked their most extreme designs and had made further progress in economic, social, and environmental justice the price of our cooperation. I understood why the people who equated political, economic, and social conservatism with God's will hated me. I wanted an America of shared benefits, shared responsibilities, and equal participation in a democratic community. The New Right Republicans wanted an America in which wealth and power were concentrated in the hands of the right people, who maintained majority support by demonizing a rolling succession of minorities whose demands for inclusion threatened their hold on power. They also hated me because I was an apostate, a white Southern Protestant who could appeal to the very people they had always taken for granted. Now that my private sins had been publicly aired, they would be able to throw stones until the day I died. I was letting go of my anger about it. But I was glad that, by accident of history, I had had the good fortune to stand against this latest incarnation of the forces of reaction and division, and in favor of a more perfect union. Chapter 53. In early June, I gave a radio address to increase awareness of mental health issues with Tipper Gore, whom I had named my official advisor for mental health and who recently had courageously revealed her own treatment for depression. 2 days later, Hillary and I joined Al and Tipper for a White House conference on mental health, in which we dealt with the staggering personal, economic, and social costs of untreated mental illness. For the rest of the month, I highlighted our gun safety proposals, our efforts to develop an AIDS vaccine, my efforts to include environmental and labor rights issues in trade talks, the report of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board on security at the Energy Department's weapons labs, a plan to restore health and disability benefits to legal immigrants, a proposal to allow Medicaid to cover disabled Americans who couldn't meet the costs of treatments if they lost their health care coverage because they entered the workforce, legislation to help older children who leave foster care to make the adjustment to independent living, and a plan to modernize Medicare and extend the life of its trust fund. I had been looking forward to July. I thought it would be a predictable, positive month. I would announce that we were taking the bald eagle off the endangered species list, and Al Gore would outline our plan to complete the restoration of the Florida Everglades. Hillary would begin her listening tour at Senator Moynihan's farm in Pender's Corner in upstate New York, and I would take a tour of poor communities across the country to promote my New Markets initiative to attract more investment to areas that were still not part of our recovery. All those things happened, but so did events that were unplanned, troublesome, or tragic. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan called and asked if he could come to Washington on July 4th to discuss the dangerous standoff with India that had begun several weeks earlier when Pakistani forces under the command of General Pervez Musharraf crossed the line of control, which had been the recognized and generally observed boundary between India and Pakistan in Kashmir since 1972. Sharif was concerned that the situation Pakistan had created was getting out of control, and he hoped to use my good offices not only to resolve the crisis, but also to help mediate with the Indians on the question of Kashmir itself. Even before the crisis, Sharif had asked me to help in Kashmir, saying it was as worthy of my attention as the Middle East and Northern Ireland. I had explained to him that the United States was involved in those peace processes because both sides wanted us. In this case, India had strongly refused involvement of any outside party. Sharif's moves were perplexing because that February, Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee had traveled to Lahore, Pakistan, to promote bilateral talks aimed at resolving the Kashmir problem and other differences. By crossing the line of control, Pakistan had wrecked the talks. I didn't know whether Sharif had authorized the invasion to create a crisis he hoped would get America involved, or had simply allowed it in order to avoid a confrontation with Pakistan's powerful military. Regardless, he had gotten himself into a bind with no easy way out. I told Sharif that he was always welcome in Washington, even on July 4th, but if he wanted me to spend America's Independence Day with him, he had to come to the United States knowing two things. First, he had to agree to withdraw his troops back across the line of control, and second, I would not agree to intervene in the Kashmir dispute, especially under circumstances that appeared to reward Pakistan's wrongful incursion. Sharif said he wanted to come anyway. On July 4th, we met at Blair House. It was a hot day, but the Pakistani delegation was used to the heat, and in their traditional white pants and long tunics, seemed more comfortable than my team. Once more, Sharif urged me to intervene in Kashmir, and again I explained that without India's consent, it would be counterproductive, but that I would urge Vajpayee to resume the bilateral dialogue if the Pakistani troops withdrew. He agreed, and we released a joint statement saying that steps would be taken to restore the line of control, and that I would support and encourage the resumption and intensification of bilateral talks once the violence had stopped. After the meeting, I thought perhaps Sharif had come in order to use pressure from the United States to provide himself cover for ordering his military to defuse the conflict. I knew he was on shaky ground at home, and I hoped he would survive, because I needed his cooperation in the fight against terrorism. Pakistan was one of the few countries with close ties to the Taliban in Afghanistan. Before our July 4th meeting, I had asked Sharif on three occasions for help in apprehending Osama bin Laden, in our meeting the previous December, at King Hussein's funeral, and in a June phone conversation and follow-up letter. We had intelligence reports that Al-Qaeda was planning attacks on U.S. officials and facilities in various places around the world, and perhaps in the United States as well. We had been successful in breaking up cells and arresting a number of Al-Qaeda members, but unless bin Laden and his top lieutenants were apprehended or killed, the threat would remain. On July 4th, I told Sharif that unless he did more to help, I would have to announce that Pakistan was in effect supporting terrorism in Afghanistan. On the day I met with Sharif, I also signed an executive order placing economic sanctions on the Taliban, freezing its assets and prohibiting commercial exchanges.
End of Disc 17.